Okay, everybody. My name is Brian Anderson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
And delighted to be here to talk to you gentlemen about emotional sobriety. I'd like to start out by saying that I'm here simply to share my experience, strength, and hope with you all. I'm not a guru or an authority on this subject. I kind of bumbled into putting together a workshop in the Houston area about a year and a half, 2 years ago, when the local intergroup asked me if I could put one together. And I said, are you sure you want this guy to talk about that? And anyway, it's come together, and I've done it several times over the last few years, and it's been pretty well received. What you're getting today, I'm just going to be giving you a kind of starter kit for a conversation here amongst the group. And the materials ran some 4 hours of presentation and interaction with the group. So this is kind of, to get it down to 20 minutes of chum on the water and get the bait in the water here is kind of a challenge, but that's kind of what I'm going to do here. And then we'll open it up, and hopefully we'll have a good, productive discussion that not only you will learn from, but I will as well. My sobriety date's June the 1st, 1993. Got sober in Houston. My home group is the Monday Night Men's Supper Step Study. And my sponsor is John C. He has 47 years sober. And he's a great guy. So, what you know when we're talking about this stuff, right? I would think if it was me sitting out there, there would be a hint of cynicism, perhaps. You know, maybe a little judgment. Who the fuck is this guy? What does he know about this? I've never seen him before. How am I going to get something useful here? Well, I'm going to invite all of you to take a mental box out, a little FedEx box, and put all that stuff in here, okay? Just maybe if you put that stuff aside, you can have it back when we're done, but let's just talk. Let's see if maybe we can absorb some things without any sort of biases or top-end prejudice about the whole thing, right? It's not Advanced Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's not Advanced Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the topic emerged when Bill Wilson wrote an essay. This was about, and I strongly encourage all of you to go out, Google this thing, or maybe you're already familiar with it. It's a beautiful essay he wrote that was later published in the Grapevine on emotional sobriety. So you can just Google Bill Wilson emotional sobriety and find it. But here he is. This is in about 1953. A lot of things happened in Alcoholics Anonymous timeline back about that time. That's when the 12 and 12 happened. It's when, you know, we got our traditions, you know, initially introduced. And Bill himself, you know, AA is a going concern. You know, up till that time, it was kind of an experiment, right? And Bill had suffered and continued to suffer from pretty extreme depression. And, you know, he had a little bit of a crisis, perhaps, but he at a crossroads, perhaps, in his spiritual development, where he admittedly said, you know, I'm looking far too much at outside things to build myself up and to feel good about Bill than I should. And, you know, some of his comments about that, I've got a few notes here I'm going to refer to here, guys. This was a PowerPoint thing, so you'll excuse me if I refer to some notes. I'm not just working from memory here. But his key focus in this essay was about maturity, balance, and humility. He talked a lot about our 11-step prayer, or the prayer of St. Francis, That's on page 99 of the Step 11 essay in the 12 and 12. And he ends it, but he talked about his dependence on outside people or circumstances to make him feel better. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a second. But when he got free of that need, he could truly love others as God loved him. That's his own comments. And he ends with, "I've been given a quiet place in bright sunshine," which is a pretty good thing to aspire to in recovery, I would say. The term emotional sobriety in our literature seems to have appeared first, outside of that essay, in the 12 and 12, in the part of the Step 12 essay where he shifts to talking about the part of the step, practice these principles in all our affairs, right? So he says in the 12 and 12, "Here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety." In my experience, this is how we achieve emotional sobriety. You know, more steps, more program, more service, thoroughly following the path, right? Doing it more thoroughly. Taking a closer look at these things. And then, you know, it's not uncommon for people that have been sober a little while. There's a lot of sobriety in this group of men. I'm thrilled to be with you guys. I love powerful groups of spiritual men in recovery. I gravitate to that. You guys are awesome, and I'll be back. But I was pointed out, I polled a lot of my friends in the program from all over the country and got back some of these things, some turning points from long-timers in their experience. One is, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. We're headed for trouble if we do. That's very familiar, right, from the Into Action in the Big Book. Another, my defects go off the rails long before I'm slamming the door or kicking the dog, right? Feeling burned out in AA, feeling stuck. How about ask my family how well I'm working the program? You know, there's a good one. I don't always get a clear picture. But one of the things Bill talks about in his essay was that he was victimized by false dependencies. This is this outside stuff thing again, right? For me, what that looked like, and I heard early in my AA experience that somebody described what their emotional state was when they got there, was like they had a hole in their chest or in their gut that the cold wind blew through, right? And turns out mine was kind of a God-shaped hole. But I struggled for years to fill that hole with alcohol, which worked really great, right? Until it didn't work. Sex, approval, being in control or in charge, avoiding discipline. You guys all know the list. Food, obsessive exercise, gambling, shopping, work, busy. All these things as a relaxer or to feel good about Brian, you know, to help me feel better. And I can actually be frantic when it comes to filling that hole, right? And then it was also described to me a bit of a death spiral that, and it's been my observation as well that, you know, there's not a, I can't coast. I can't, you know, I'm with Joe and Charlie on steps 10, 11, and 12. They say, they take issue with the idea that we have maintenance steps. They say these are growth steps. Because I'm on a slippery slope. I'm an alcoholic. I've got a chronic, fatal, progressive disease. And if I'm not moving up that slope, I'm moving backwards. And so that death spiral might start with stop praying. Don't call my sponsor. Don't go to meetings. No AA service. Acting out, getting dishonest. Starting to form and harbor resentments. Living in fear, taking a drink, you know. So, some of the comments made by some members. This is the difference between getting sober and staying sober. Step 6 and 7 repeated over and over helped me gain emotional sobriety. Facing problems without numbing them. Now, you guys, please be thinking about this, because this isn't a lecture. This is a workshop. And when I'm done talking, I'm going to be passing to you guys to ping pong around and talk about this, right? So please be forming some thoughts here as we go. I've got to surrender the attempt to achieve a better or different past. That's set. That's done. I can't change it. As I do the work of recovery, it gets better than I could have dreamed. I've got to stay away from regurgitating my troubles. I need fellowship. Hence my posse of men. And some general ideas on emotional sobriety, something that you guys have modeled to me already in this forum. That is transparency. I have to open myself up to share with you. You know, I came up in the John Wayne handbook of being a man, right? You don't show any of that shit. It is taboo. And when I get transparent with you, that gives you license to be the same with me, right? So that whole thing, one alcoholic sharing with another in love. I hear God through AA members. Anybody identify with that? Find someone who has what you want and ask how they got that way. Prioritizing morning prayer and meditation and try to live a balanced life. One big one for me, and it goes back to a quote that I was meant to start with here. Emmett Fox, who was a guy that impacted especially the New York AAs in the mid-30s, has a quote in his Daily Reader that I just love. It's on this topic: right reaction is the supreme art of life. So, for me, emotional sobriety, a lot of it comes down to the difference between reacting and responding, right? So, I have a stimulus. Somebody cuts me off in traffic. My wife gives me friendly advice about driving directions. You know, I hit myself with a hammer. You know, the clock starts, right? That's where God can work in there, right? Or if I just, as is my normal nature, just hit the response button, a react button, and it's anger. It's anger, it's rage, it's, you know, not good. Generally not going to end well. But if I give it the time, I have the opportunity to respond, which is a much more spiritual approach to the whole thing, right? That's an emotional sobriety example, in my view. And this is one that really resonates with me. I'm guilty of being an approval junkie. I don't know how many people out here might have that going on, but actually believing that what other people think of me is none of my business. Yeah, it's important to not be a dick, but at the same time, you know, to be obsessed with what you think about me, you know, no. I got to live a good spiritual life and leave that to, you know, to what happens. So, emotional sobriety, that means we've got to talk about that ugly topic of feelings a little bit, right? So, which is a little bit different than shut up, sit down, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, or put the plug in the jug. You know, this is kind of stuff, which is all good stuff. I'm not being critical of that, but once I'm sober, I've given up my license to change how I feel chemically. I don't have that anymore. So, like I was sharing with somebody today, sober, one of my favorite acronyms for the word sober is son of a bitch, everything is real. Right? All those feelings have got to be felt. And what I normally would do, my normal state is to stuff it not show you anything, stuff it and grow a tumor or get an ulcer or go home and kick the dog, you know, or take it out on in a sideways way, in a passive-aggressive way on somebody that doesn't deserve that. And if I fully feel these feelings, I don't have to act on them because I can learn from them. And then Chuck C. From A New Pair of Glasses. Fabulous, fabulous statement that's so timeless. I can't think my way into right action, but I can act my way into right thinking. So into action, taking action, being in service. That's a huge piece of emotional sobriety. And then, you know, as we go through the steps, there's certain areas where it talks about places where we really get emotionally sober, right? Or get glimpses of that. Like, how about in the big book where we just finished our fifth step and it says we're walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. That's pretty emotionally sober, I'd say. So, how about a new practice? Okay, so we're practicing these principles in all our affairs again, right? A new practice. Perhaps we're a little bit alternative if you struggle with emotional sobriety. Some ideas might be quit making a big deal out of ordinary situations. I'm not alone in this room as somebody who has a tendency to overreact to things, right? Do nothing. You know, it's amazing how many things in my life respond very positively to doing nothing. You know, if I don't have to go die on every hill in every engagement. I can let them peter out like a forest fire that, you know, just let it burn out. I can disengage from the chaos. You know, my Astros are getting their asses kicked in the seventh inning. I can switch it off. I don't have to watch it right to the end and go crazy. Right? How important is it? And I can focus my mind on solutions. I'm almost done here. No, we'll get over to you guys here. Some other thoughts about changing my thinking are being open to outside professional help. You know, that's something. AA, we don't do that. We simply don't provide medical advice in Alcoholics Anonymous. However, our literature tells us that we should avail ourselves of those people. You know, and I personally have had some great breakthroughs in long-standing problems when I took that path. You know, the one caution there is find a good one. You know, ask around. Find somebody who's trusted and is good at their trade in that area. Positive self-talk. Anybody here got an internal critic that talks to them a little bit? Yeah? Yeah, I got one of those. Feed my mind with positive inputs. Reject negative thinking. And probably one of the most important is to consider and embrace the spiritual. You know, here in the southern tier of states of the United States, we've got a pretty heavy emphasis on the spiritual as part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been blessed in my recovery by being able to attend Alcoholics Anonymous all over the planet, in some pretty far-flung places. And, you know, it's pretty common. It's getting more and more common to sit in meetings and to not even have the word God mentioned, you know, which to me is amazing. You know, but you know, I'm not here to criticize anything. I'm just saying I feel blessed to have AA the way it is here, and that for me, I crave that part. It's a very important part, and that to embrace the spiritual. I mean, step 11, mea culpa here. I spent 29 years into recovery without developing a proper meditation practice. But once I did, I started attending in Houston, we've got a once a week meditation meeting, right, where people get in a group, we read the 11-step prayer, there's a 20-minute group meditation, and then we share about that. But what that has done for me is it's busted open the door to where I get at least 10 minutes of meditation every single day. You know? And it makes a huge difference. It really, it adds up. It makes a big difference. The literature is so important. I gravitate not only towards men, but also to literature-based meetings. It's hard to get too far off track. One suggestion I have that has really also worked for me in terms of my emotional sobriety and just staying focused on this program is, you know, when you've been in literally thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and you're sitting there and they're reading how it works, it's very, very difficult to hear it, right? To really hear it. So bring your book and read it when it's being read. It's a fabulous practice. Fabulous practice. And you know what? They keep putting new stuff in there. They do. Okay, and then there's some other publications. There's some AA publications. Grapevine has a couple of books where they've made compilations of some of the stories in the Grapevine that are about emotional sobriety. I like the idea of growing your posse. It's been mentioned from the podium up here a few times already, but you know, be proactive. Invest in your relationships with these men. It takes work. It takes work to not just you know, be chummy in the conference, but to actually grow, nurture, and build new relationships and old relationships with men you love. And tell them you love them. Journaling is a big one for me. Big one. I'll share with you very briefly a emotional sobriety story from my own experience. I was 2 months ago in the Canadian Rockies dragging a trailer around with my wife, trying to stay out of the broiler that is Houston, Texas in the summertime. And we were having a sandwich at the rest stop, and she looked at me and said, "I don't feel good." And she fell over and threw up everything and just, she had a stroke. And over the next 12 hours, my life went from normal to totally, you know, crazy. And I didn't know if this woman that I loved was going to even be alive when I followed her EMS team and ambulance over to Calgary. And but you know what happened was, in the midst of that, I'm driving through the mountains, absolutely berserk and crazy, and my disease came back and told me, "Hey, Brian, we know how to make that go away. We can make this feel better." And I got thirsty. You know, I'm 30 years sober, and I got thirsty. And what did I do? Well, it's one of those crossroads that we have in our sobriety, right? What do? Do you drink? Or do you do the other thing? Which is what we talk about in all these damn meetings and stuff, and with book studies and everything else. I picked up the phone and I called some of my posse. And they talked me back off the ledge, right? And my wife, she's okay, but, you know, my point of all that is that you never know, man. I mean, you never, ever know. I'm not one to sit there waiting for the sword of Damocles to fall on my head. But at the same time, you know, shit happens. You know, shit happens. And I better have my powder dry. More step work. If you haven't done a fourth and fifth step in the last couple years, my suggestion is to do a new one. There's always some good stuff to come out of that. And step out of your comfort zone. How about get a new AA service job? All these things will help with growing in emotional sobriety. One last thing before I open it up. One of the things I've observed, too, in terms of emotional sobriety is, you know, seeing what the old-timers do, following their examples. You know, I'm a baby duck still. I have a whole bunch of heroes in this deal, and I like to follow them, and I like to emulate them. And some of the biggest ones were ones that lost children. You know, one of the greatest tragedies a person can have in an adult life is to lose, to bury a child. And to do that and to stay sober. You know, I've got four different friends in Alcoholics Anonymous in Houston that have done that. We've all known people, and these guys, that have died, who got the cure, you know, and done it sober, right? From lingering disease and other things like that. Those people, for me, they punched my ticket. See, having my kid die was my escape hatch back here. I always thought that maybe, God forbid, something happened to my daughter, one of my daughters, I could go have a drink because it would be that bad. But those guys, modeling that they could do it without drinking, punched that ticket. I can't do that anymore. So with that, I'll have a couple comments to wrap it up, but let's embark on a little discussion here about this. And the kind of overall topic here, emotional sobriety, just to keep it succinct, what is it in your view, and what are the key practices to both gain and maintain it? Right? Simple. So, I'm happy to point fingers, but how about a volunteer or two to kick it off? Yes, sir.
How's it going?
Hi, Bill.
My sponsor is to tell a story about himself. When he got cut off in traffic in Atlanta, which is almost as bad as Houston's, he chased the guy all the way from Sandy Springs to Hateville. And he caught the guy, and the guy pulled a gun off. Mm-hmm. And they just walked away. And that was, no. But I heard a speaker later on talk about doing the same sort of thing. But he said he thought he had made some progress because now he still got mad when somebody cut him off in traffic, but he did not go past his normal exit. And that was, in his own mind, was an improvement. And because of this, my sponsor and I over the years had a lot of conversations about that. One of the things that he suggested was that imagine why that person cut you off in traffic. Maybe it's a lady driving her husband, who just had a heart attack, to the hospital to save his life. And she had a good reason for cutting him off in traffic. And that made perfect sense to me. Imagine why she's doing that sort of thing. And that, to me, was when I'm able to do that, and I don't do it all the time, and don't do it perfectly rarely, but, you know, I see those things and say, that's got to be some sort of emotional, you know, growth.
Absolutely.
Maturity.
Right.
The one other thing, and you talked about your daughter, the drinking over the death of a child, it's not going to change anything. You know, understand, it's not going to bring her back. You know, and those are the things like today I would not have imagined, would not have even entered my mind when I was drinking. Because drinking was, I drank when I was happy, drank when I was sad, whatever. But it never changed anything. The only thing that happened is the same problem is there tomorrow morning, and I've got a hangover. Thanks for letting me share that.
Thank you. I'm Lauren, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Lauren,
feel free to speak up about that.
Okay, I'll speak as loud as I can. So, you know, I appreciate what the other gentleman shared. You know, when I was in early sobriety, emotional sobriety was very hard for me. I came in here with a lot of anger and a lot of frustration, and it tended to show itself in traffic. And as I've gotten some years of clean time, I can measure my spiritual wellness, if you want to call it that, my spiritual condition, by how I behave behind the wheel of my car. Everything else has kind of stabilized. I'm pretty good at work. I'm pretty good in family situations. I'm pretty good in social situations. But when I get behind the wheel of the car, that unsober, alcoholic, drug-addicted monster comes out and wants to drive the car for me. And so when I'm in a good spiritual condition, I can handle traffic. I can recognize that that person who cut in front of me in traffic was just trying to get their exit. They weren't doing something to me. You know, it's not about me when I'm emotionally sober. One of the things that has helped me tremendously, and this is so simple it's stupid, but, you know, the Serenity Prayer says, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. That's everything outside of me. To change the things I can, that's me. Right? I can change my behavior. I can alter what I do. I can alter responding to other people in character qualities rather than reacting in my character defects, right? That I have control of. And then the wisdom to recognize the difference. And for me, you know, one of the things I like to say is my hindsight is 20/20. About 10 minutes after I've done something I shouldn't have done, I recognize what I should have done, right? Which is why Bill Wilson and the founders gave us the 10th step so that I can go back quickly and fix those things that I screwed up. And, you know, if I'm doing those things, it helps me to stay more spiritually centered, more spiritually fit. And then the other thing that I find that helps tremendously is working with others and helping other people. For those of you who are new here and who are not ready to start sponsoring, you don't have to. You can help another person by showing them where the meeting is. You can help another person by taking their phone call. You can help another person, believe it or not, by picking up the phone and calling them and asking them how their day is going. That will help both of you, believe it or not. If you say, how are you doing today? And then you shut your mouth and genuinely listen to the answer, you're both going to get something out of that experience. And so those are a few things that I do for spiritual sobriety and to help myself. And I'm not good at it. I will tell you, I'm my sobriety date is June 10th, 2007, and I feel like I'm just starting to get my head above water and just getting to a point in my recovery where I can respond in character qualities rather than reacting in character defects, and where I can recognize that other people's behavior is not a reflection on me, and that I don't have to be responsible for what that other person does, and that I'm just a bit player in their movie. Right? I'm not the main character in somebody else's movie. It's not about me. And it's taken 16 years to get to that point. So if you're new here, be patient, work the steps. Talk to your sponsor frequently, especially when you're up in your head saying, I just need to get this guy back. Getting him back isn't going to feel good in the long run. And your sponsor can help you help talk you off the ledge and give you more constructive ways to deal with it. Thank you for letting me share.
Pardon me, I stand up. My name is David Looker. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, David. Good to be here again. I've been sober 30 years. Been to the Rock a bunch of times. Been to more workshops than I can count. Well, early on in sobriety, I was blessed to have the most remarkable men put in my path. And one of those who spoke here many times was named Kip Collins. And some of you might recognize the name. Maybe you heard the CD. The man's story was just off the wall, awesome, and tragic all at the same time. Kip became one of my dearest friends. He lived near me, went to a book study at his house, and he gave to me some incredible concepts that were hard to swallow. I went to him one time with a story about a guy that I was really worried about. And the man, Kip, he's crashing and burning, man. You know? And Kip said, you know, he listened to me about it, and he said, David, who are you to interrupt his journey to his bottom? Sounds like he hasn't hit his bottom yet. He used to consider the gift of desperation to be a serious gift in this program. And I came to realize that he's very true about that. Because it's when we get desperate enough do we become teachable and open to other than our own thinking. I got those gifts from him. One of the biggest ones I got from him was, I asked him one day, you know, Kip, so what are you, where are you at in your recovery? What are you seeking here? And he said, David, I will always be seeking to become an interested observer in life. Not everything that happens is about me. I may be here when it happens. It's not necessarily about me. And you know, I chewed on that a long time. I chewed on that like a cow with his cud, you know. It was a tough one. You know, but in the years since Kip's passed, and even before, one of the many gifts that he gave me was this notion. Am I being an interested observer? He used to say, when you go get in traffic, he used to say, go get in line, man. Take your place in line. That was his attitude. Well, time to go get in line. Another one was, I'm driving along. Look at this motherfucker over here. He can't stay in his lane. Asshole. He'd say, how about this? How about we just drive the one car? Right? Think about that. Think about when you're driving and that happens, you know how it happens. Critiquing everything around us at all times. How about we just drive this one car? How about that? Kip was a wealth of gifts. And he handed me one of the greatest ones of all time. I was estranged from my daughter for 10 years when I first got sober. Both my kids. And after 10 years of sobriety, I'm sitting in Kip's garden, and I said, Kip, I've been to the Rock. I've been to a lot of stuff, and it's time. I got to make amends to my daughter. We'd started a little bit of a conversation, and the door was open a crack, and I said, Kip, I got to go make amends to my daughter, and I know you've done that. What can you help me with? And he says, well, David, you can't do that. He said, you can't do that until you know what you're making amends for. And I said, well, you didn't mean that. I know. Right? We know, don't we? We know how we work. And he said, really? You know, huh? No kidding. How many times did she cry herself to sleep? How many times was she too sick to go to school because she was worried sick about you? How many times? Tell me. I don't know. Oh, but you know what you owe her amends for. He said, how about this? How about you ask her just a simple question and then shut the fuck up? He said, ask her what it was like for her
to have you for a father. Try that. And if you're lucky, David, if you're seriously lucky, and she loves you enough, she'll tell you the truth. And if she tells you the truth, you might finally know what you owe her a mentor. The greatest gift I've ever gotten from any one man in this program. And I did that with my daughter. And we are the dearest of friends today. And it would never, ever have happened without a man who had more emotional sobriety than I can begin to describe, whose sole goal in life was to become an interested observer in this journey of ours, who cared passionately about people but didn't want to interrupt people's journey to their bottoms. Because, see, it wasn't all about him. Very little was ever about him. And all those lessons, all those things I've gathered, all have contributed to the sense of what emotional sobriety is. Am I always in emotional sobriety? Oh my God, no. But I know enough to be able to stop and pause and reflect on that very subject and check myself. Right? Am I driving just the one car? Am I giving everybody a fair shake? Am I being an interested observer? Or is it really all about me again? Those few things, those few little checkoffs that I can do on a regular basis have helped. You know, and I still aspire to have emotional sobriety. I truly do. And thanks for letting me share.
Thanks.
Yeah, hey, my name's Lee. I'm an alcoholic. 59-year-old, 15-year-old. That's hard to swallow, but it's the case. I've learned a couple things in my 260-some-odd days in the program, actually applying myself to it, applying it to my life. One thing I picked up was that, you know, people say, I've lost everything. You didn't lose it. You traded it. Traded it for your alcohol, for your drug, for your whatever it is. That's what I found. I traded it off. I didn't lose it. It was mine to keep. I gave it away. Okay, I got to live with that one. Another one, my wife had a medical condition last year. She had a drug interaction that caused her to have her ears ringing permanently. And this was right before I got sober. She had a crisis. She had an emotional breakdown, and I wasn't seeing it. I didn't see a bone sticking out, so I didn't realize she was hurt, and I didn't accept it. I was like, honey, if we go to the ER on Saturday night while I'm trying to watch the Bulldogs win this championship, I'm not going to see my game. I'm not going to enjoy my alcohol. It's going to ruin my buzz. We went to the hospital, much begrudgingly. You know, I didn't want to go. Sat there 6 hours. They didn't do a damn thing. They didn't help her at all. They told her, you got anxiety. Go home. I said, I told you so. For a year, I let that ride. She tried to approach me twice, saying, look, this was an issue. This was a problem. I blew it off both times. Ah, you're just full of shit. You don't know what you're talking about. I'm not the one that was hurting. I'm the one that was perceiving it. I had to understand that she was hurting. Last night she sat me down. She said, you're going to this men's thing. You're going to need to get, you need to get some shit straight here. This is a big problem. Let's discuss it. So we did. And I sat there and I listened to her for almost an hour. I didn't say a word. I just listened and absorbed what she was saying and how it affected her, not how it affected me. And it took a lot because I wanted to say, it's the same thing, honey. They didn't do shit for you. They didn't do anything. Nobody helped. It wasn't any good. No, that's not what she wanted. She just wanted to be validated. She just wanted to me to understand that she was hurting. So this morning when I got up before I came here, I said, honey, I didn't help before. I realized that. There's nothing I can do to change how I behaved before. But what I can tell you now is that going forward, you're the one that's hurting. I'm the one that has to listen and understand that and absorb that. It's not me that's hurting. So for me to take it out of myself and put it into her perspective was a whole big thing for me. It was hard. Not an easy thing to do. But I did it, and I wanted to bring it here. That's why I'm speaking about it now, because it shook me up real bad. I have to take myself out of myself and look at me from another perspective. How is this person perceiving this issue, this concern? And it's not all about me. It's not. It's about other people in life, and I'm trying to learn that. That's why I'm here being a 59-year-old, 15-year-old this evening. Hopefully I can carry something home that I've learned from you guys, and that's what I wanted to bring out. Thanks.
Thank you. Sir. My name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic.
Alan. Thank you for this topic. This is something that I struggle with on a daily basis. I can get emotionally drunk real fast. I might be physically sober, but my mental state will get drunk. I will get drunk in my mind. I work for a sober living. We have 50 guys that I'm basically, you know, responsible for, I guess is a way to put it. So, in working in the recovery field, I went to my first rehab I went to was on a 40-acre farm, and we were all giving each other hugs and doing whatever we could do to help one another, right? We were like a big group of, you know, just love and tolerance for everybody. And getting back into the real world, it's not like that, you know, like it's masculinity, you know, we don't walk around giving each other hugs all day. And coming out of that treatment center, I came into this sober living wanting to help everybody that I could and do anything I could to help these guys. To the point that I wasn't taking care of myself. And something I've really had to realize here recently was that I'm not responsible for anybody's recovery but my own. All we do is we provide a place for them to be able to work a program, a safe environment to work a program of recovery. And that I'm not responsible for their recovery. And I've really been having to take some time to myself and continue to work on myself with my sponsor. And every morning I get up and I read the morning reflection. You know, upon awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. So, me being an alcoholic, I'm selfish and self-centered. So I wanted to be all about Alan all the time. But it can't be that way. I still have to give freely of what I've been given, but I still have to be able to watch out for me. So, throwing myself, you know, just overboard and trying to help somebody else is great. And the book says that, you know, when we're hurting, we're supposed to, you know, help another alcoholic. And I do that on a daily basis. And, you know, in the book it says that Bill tried to, you know, he had all these guys that he was bringing into this house, and none of them stayed sober. Well, he asked Lois, he said, "Lois, what's going on? You know, I don't know, I'm not helping anybody." And she said, "Yeah, but Bill, you're sober." And I have to remind myself of that. And in dealing with these guys, I have to practice love and tolerance. And a lot of times I have to say to myself, when agitated or doubtful, we pause and pray for the right thought or decision. Because me as an alcoholic, I want to react to everything. But I have to stop and I have to think about what I'm going to say, because for me, I'm still emotional. You know, very, very emotional, because I suppressed all these emotions for so long that, you know, now that I'm sober, all these emotions are coming back up and I don't necessarily have to know how to deal with them. And I have to remember that these guys are like that too. So the way that I have to watch my words. Words are powerful. And, you know, people have said things to me that get me emotionally drunk. So, one of my first sponsors, he said, the three M's of recovery, moderation, meditation, and masturbation. So, you know, the moderation part, right? I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. I take everything to the extreme. So, all right, so I need to moderate. And I haven't been moderating my eating. I put on like 50 pounds since I've been sober. But it is what it is, right? So I'm trying to work on that. Meditation. What I've been doing is I've been going and getting in the sauna at the gym. And I take my big book in the sauna and I read the morning meditation at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I'll open up to just a random, I have like a little 164-page big book that I take in their sauna with me. So I'll just open up to a random page and I'll read for 10 or 15 minutes. And then I'll sit there and just meditate on what I've read. And it's so funny how what I've read that day ends up coming back up some way or another with some situation that pops up during that day. And I have how Bill and Bob would have responded, or how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous expects me to respond being in recovery to these situations. And, sir?
We'll leave that last bit.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, you remind me of, not, I say that in jest, but, you know, it's a God-given desire, and it's certainly something to deal with. I also am kind of inspired to just mention briefly, you know, it's been an observation of mine and others, you know, it's a wonderful thing that so many of us get engaged in the trade of recovery, you know, and the business of recovery. But it's a very dangerous thing to think that work is a program of recovery. You know, and I see you guys shaking your head. I do that all day. I don't need to sponsor people or work my own steps or have my own program. You know, it really is essential to do that, I think. I was going to ask,
sir.
Wow, sir, all these hands.
Sir, what were the two? You gave us two props. What were they?
Two props.
Prompts. You said what is emotional sobriety?
Oh, yeah. What is it, and what are the key practices to gain and maintain it? Did you want to share on that?
Yeah, but if other people had their hands up, go.
Okay, yeah. Herbert, right here.
Thanks, my name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. So I have a sponsor, and I sponsor guys, and the guys that I sponsor are watching. Now, and I'm a participant in my life. And I don't want to. I don't want to behave in a way that is not a sober guy. And I learned what a sober guy is from you guys. You know, the guys that have time, and even some guys don't have as much time. Watch how they behave in situations: heart attacks, loss of jobs, broken shoestring. You know, little things like that. I saw a guy this weekend. He was fishing on my boat, been sober 30 years, and fancies himself a good fisherman. Don't we all? And we're about another 20 minutes, and we got to head in, and he bird nests his spool. He then forgets the trolling motor's on. So as he's trying to figure out this bird's nest, his rod tip starts bouncing. Well, I'm back there going, man, you got a huge fish on there. And he looks at me very calmly and he says, is your trolling motor on? And I said, yep. He goes, would you turn it off, please? And I realized at that point he had wound up his fishing line in that trolling motor. So I'm like, we're done. Going in now. I'm going to have to take the spool off the trolling motor. It's okay. I got a half inch wrench. That's happened before. And he calmly sat there and unwound the line off that trolling motor sitting off the end of my boat as we went back in it, you know, slow, so I didn't throw him off. But I watched him. I filmed him, waiting for him to go for the love of God. And I showed it to my sponsor, who's been sober 25 years. And my sponsor said that he had surgery in his eye. And everything that could go wrong went wrong. He said, but all I kept thinking about was Dale calmly unwinding all of that fishing line. And if he could do that, then maybe all I got to do is make it to the next thing. And not throw the kid out with the laundry, not jump off a cliff, but just understand that this is just part of the step I'm in right now, and I'll just take another one. As long as I don't overreact and act like an idiot and cause current damage, I get through it. And that's the kind of stuff I learn from, you know. I own a business, and I had a guy call me up, and he says, you're the most terrible company I have ever worked with, and you will not be doing my drywall in the future. And I got my sponsor, and I hang out with my sponsor a lot. We're like buds, you know. I believe in that. If you're sponsoring somebody or getting sponsored by a guy, you probably should have a relationship with them other than a phone call once a week. That's just me. So I show him my phone. Oh, look at that. How would you respond to such that? Telling you that you suck and your drywall company is terrible. He's never going to use you again. How would you respond to that? And he says, okay. Man, I'm never using you again. Okay. And I said, John, that is awesome. And guess whose drywall we still do is drywall. Nobody had to call anybody names. Just, okay. And I love that stuff about sober guys. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Great.
Great.
I'm not going to get Scott. Thank you both for your service, all this good stuff. I was sitting there thinking about, you know, I read that so many times about emotional sobriety, and for me, it's about the part about making demands on other people, unreasonable demands, right? So when I don't make demands on somebody else, you know, I don't get a resentment against them because they don't, it doesn't matter, right? So that for me is what gives me like a lot of peace and serenity, is not like worrying about what you do. You know, the problem is that in theory it's free, you know, but the reality it's very, it doesn't always work that way. And, you know, it gets me aggravated, it gets me, you know, all up in the thing. But I just got help though from this guy right here, because, you know, a lot of my job and my livelihood is based on what other people think of me, right? I need your approval. I need you to buy my stuff. All these certain things, and you know, I'm an artist. I'm a painter, right? And not everyone wants my shit, right? Right? And the answer is okay, right? And that is so key, because I was sitting there thinking about, like, you know, how can I apply it to other people, but how do I apply it to myself? And that's the answer. It's just okay. Because, you know, there's going to be someone that likes it and some people that don't like it, and it doesn't fucking matter, you know. But that is the hardest thing, is to like accept that, you know. And when I do, I can go on about my business and paint my little pictures and sell whoever wants them, and you know, and life is great. But if I sit there and worry about like how many like likes are on Facebook or Instagram or whatever it is that I need to do, it's like, It drives me insane. It drives me insane. So, I just want to thank you for that. Okay, because that really is all that you can do, right? And me trying to control, you know, what you like about me is just a utter waste of time. And you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to do what I need to do anyway, right? And hopefully not drink about it, because that's the key, right? Because if I get resentful about, you know, how you think of me or what, you know, what I want you to do, and making demands on you, it's just like, I love being sober, right? I love having the freedom to do what I do now, and when I do that, I'm peaceful, I'm serene, and life is good. So I appreciate the topic for me. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks. I was going to ask my friend Mark here, who's on the end of the
say a few words. Do you have anything you'd like to share?
Hey, buddy, my name's Art Sutherland. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Brian. Brian's a dear friend. Y'all know me from the Rock. I've been here for a minute. And I didn't choose y'all. I fell in with y'all. Then God, in His favor, sent me to Texas with a career path. And I fell in with Brian. And it's the same stuff. Same, you know, the shit y'all were telling me, he tells me the same thing. It's amazing how that works. So what I've heard tonight is powerful in what I believe, and it's worked for me. But if I stand up here and talk like I'm emotionally sober, please don't buy into that. I might be emotionally sober for a minute. But I love that chip you pull out of your pocket, because I'd keep one of them. You know, when I used to promise myself that I'll go 15 minutes in between hits of crack. And I never did. And it would be about the same thing with a sobriety chip for emotional sobriety. I don't do that as well as I want to. But what I see in y'all, and I hear in all of what we're trying to do, is that's what we seek. That's the target we aim for. And some days, some few minutes, I do it really well. And in some few minutes, I'm an embarrassment to sobriety as a word. So, what I've heard tonight is continually working the steps with a... This is ABCs of our deal when we start. Continually working the steps with a competent sponsor and paying attention, David. How many times did we hear that from that man you referred to? I can't tell you guys how many times Kip and I were talking on the phone and he'd say, pay attention, Art. Click. Just like that. And that's what he means, is watch out for this stuff coming at me. So, as you talk, and as all of y'all talk, I'll end anything I got to say with this. At the end of the 12, at the end of step 7, in 12 and 12, it's talking about humility. But it gives me the solution to emotional sobriety. If I'll practice the same degree that God graced me with, that got me free from alcohol and drugs, if I'll practice that same degree of humility, it says in the 12 and 12, with any other problem. And this probably gives me better handle on my emotions if I'll practice it that way. It's a tall order. And I love how some of y'all have said, if I'll aim high, I might land. If I aim really high, you know, the bullet might fall down and hit something out there. And so that's what I try to do. And I want to. And here I am again at the 6-month gas fill up. And I'm just so grateful. I am so grateful for what God just fell me in with y'all. I didn't choose this path. I just fell in here. And what, you know, I submit to y'all, I'm God's favorite. I assure you, He likes me better than anybody, anytime. Love you guys.
Thank you.
Good to know. I don't know if this is on topic, but it something that you said made me want to share about this. You were talking about networking with fellows and building a posse, or finding your posse in this, that, and the other. And it made me think of the way I like to picture it, or the analogy. And this is something that my wife said before I ever even met her back in Arizona. But she always said, you know, run with the pack, stick with the pack, run with the herd, you know, run with the gazelles. Because if you're off on the side, you might get picked off. And that's just a great analogy to me. And that's kind of how I see it. Just stick with the pack. And I met a new guy here, and we haven't exchanged phone numbers yet, but I just kind of wanted to, you know, just mentioned that. And I just love, like, what you said about networking and everything. It's huge, whether it's meetings, The Rock, phone calls all day long, text, just somebody that you can just connect with, even if it's just whether you're feeling good or not, just something to keep it all going. Because we can't, you know, we got to live this program outside of the rooms, you know. And that's a great way to do it. You know, this program's designed so that we can live in the real world, you know, but these connections really keep us together. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you, John. Just
real briefly mention one piece that I didn't include in the notes, but it was considered one of the workshops that I do. And that is a suggestion for, you know, the field group, fellowship and a tight group of men to get some progress in some key areas of emotional sobriety and recovery in general, is to do a step 6 and 7 work week. And, you know, 4, 5, 6 guys that are, especially ones that know each other pretty well, guys that you can study this topical information and literature on this, those steps, and then, but include in the and I'm, see me after the meeting if you'd like to try this. I've got a meeting format I'd be delighted to share with you. But part of it is to go around the circle at the end of the meeting, and each man puts out a stretch that he's going to do between now and the next meeting. So adding in the accountability, you know. And because I love this man that's also in the circle enough, in a loving way, I can poke him in the chest and say, listen, son, bitch, I've heard you bitch about this, son of a gun, da 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 da, the last 5 years. When are you going to get serious about this? How can I help you do something? In a loving way. But you know, and then knowing that you're going to circle back and have to talk to these guys about the same stuff, it's possible. You know, I've done that twice with different groups of men. Every single man involved had a bridge on something. Just a thought.
My definition of emotional sobriety is when life's easy. Gracefully, effortlessly, and you know, I'm doing what I need to be doing, one foot after the other, and I'm okay. How do I get there? I do a lot of what you said. He's the big speaker tomorrow night, and then I'm doing a talk on anger tomorrow night, and like I want to get as many of you people here. No one has to come. He just gave the whole talk, so not, you guys don't have to, because you know you deal with anger just like you deal with everything else. You deal with it. You don't, you know. So for me, it's like someone said extremes. I was always an extreme dude. If 4 was good, give me 8. If 8 was good, give me 23. So like I try and get away from the extremes, you know, and feelings. Like, you know, I could be a cold robot or I could be just too much feeling. I got to hit the middle of the road. You know, I think there's 2 parts to this program. Part 1, don't drink, don't do drugs. Part 2, be a better human. And I feel like that's my journey here. I think emotional sobriety, 53 that he wrote the thing? 1950?
It was published in 53, I think.
So 53, and it, you know, it's been, that's been a while, and I think we kind of revisit it in phases, but, you know, a lot of people think the whole goal of this thing is to not drink. That's the beginning. Then it's getting everything else, you know? And I'm working in my backyard. I get a call from my 18-year-old son. He's gone 2 years without an accident, and his accident 285, and he's like losing his shit. I'm like, it's okay. And I reacted the way I would want my dad to react to me. And he's okay. You know, it's going to cost money. And that's it. You know, and I'm going to go to court with him, and we're going to, you know, try and fix what we could fix. And that's what I want to do. I want to treat others the way, I want to treat them the way I want them to treat me. And then serenity, you know, and Art, you talked about gratitude and peace and just, you know, enjoying this shit. So that's kind of where I'm at. I appreciate your lead, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's do just a couple more. White hat, right there.
Hey, man. My name's Dr. Brian. I'm good afternoon. Thank you for feeding us. For me, my emotional sobriety is contingent upon my spiritual growth and my connection with my source, my higher power. See, you were talking about feelings. Well, I'm trained in feelings. Because I was an actor. And I know that a feeling is nothing more than a thought manifested in physicality. And if I can learn to change the thought, I can change the feeling. Page 84 in the big book helps me start that process. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God to remove them. That's change the thought, because I'm not relying on myself to do it. I'm seeking a source greater than myself. And we discuss it with somebody immediately. Once again, I've changed the thought, because now I'm getting feedback from somebody else. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone who we can help. And I can almost guarantee, if I do that, that feeling will change. It may not change forever, but it will change for that instant. And I can add instances together, and then eventually I won't succumb to those particular type of feelings anymore. Or at least they'll be minimalized. Because, see, I go thermonuclear. Fuck, we ain't gonna talk. You know, I don't lose my temper, and I'm sorry, Dave. I don't lose my temper so much as I give away my peace. And I give it away for nothing. I let you have so much power over me that I nut up. So I got three magic words: don't nut up. Now, what I've had to do was I've had to, you know, it talks about going to other sources. Well, I haven't used professional help, but there are other sources, other literature. One of them is a book written by Dr. Paul O, who wrote Dr. Alcoholic Addict, and the book is You Can't Make Me Angry, which deals with emotional sobriety in 6 and 7. There are other books, like there's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem by Dr. Wayne Dyer, who was one of us. And he gives me all these things to help change my initial thinking. See, I have to learn, once a thought comes, if it's not a right thought, to change the thought, and that's going to change how I feel. So, I want to be cool all the time. So we talked about being an observer. Well, I want to be an observer, and the key, the hit, is being an observer without having an opinion on what I'm observing. I'm just observing it. I can then go back and decide, What I have observed, is that going to be a reflection of who I really am and who I want to be? And if it doesn't fit within those parameters, then I can look at something else. What did the eagle say? Nothing wrong as far as I can see. We make this harder than it has to be. I can't tell you why. Thanks for letting me share.
My name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
And Brian, thanks for your lead. And sometimes I think it's easier to know what emotional sobriety isn't.
That was great. Thank you.
And I'm doing that image management. I care what people think. certainly I didn't know anything about it prior to getting sober. I appreciate somebody bringing up moderation earlier, and have a guy that I sponsor. He says the only things alcoholics do in moderation is take the steps. And that was the case for me. But fortunately, when I got serious about AA, I got a sponsor. He took me through the big book, and he asked to start sponsoring people. And, you know, I think that has really allowed me to have glimpses of emotional sobriety. I think it's really when you practice principles in all your affair. In my first home group, we had a speaker meeting, and a speaker one time said, and I would tell my sponsor, I just can't meditate. This guy says, I've really been able to develop a practice of meditation. I meditate a minute every day. I thought, oh, that gave me hope, you know, and I started being able to practice other things. But what I did want to bring up is you brought up that people lose children, and that happened to me. In my second year of sobriety, I woke up one morning, my wife asked me to go down and wake up my son, Stuart. I went down and I found him dead. And without going into the entire story, I called my sponsor. Minutes later, he is over my house because he lived relatively close. A short while after that, other members of my home group showed up. My friend Art was one of the ones that showed up. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous and the members of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me stay sober that day. I can tell you that morning what I did when I got up. I got on my knees and asked God to help me stay sober. Went downstairs and read devotional literature. I did what I was doing then. I was a couple years sober. I talked to a couple guys I sponsored. But you know, when calamity hit, God was there, and I had just enough peace of mind, just enough emotional sobriety. But I can tell you, I was an absolute mess. An absolute mess. But I remember one thing Art and I did is we went downstairs. My son lived in the basement. He died by suicide. It's a complicated death. He had hung himself. But Art and I went down there to the area where I'd found him. And he helped me sort of break the spell. Other men in Alcoholics Anonymous, including my sponsor, helped with that as well. You know, over time, it's taken a lot of work. But what I can tell you I did is I found my son on a Wednesday. That Friday night, it was a speaker meeting, his birthday night at my home group. And I said, AA. I stayed engaged in AA. About 2 weeks later, I was back going through the big book with the guys I was going through the big book with. And I don't know if I helped them, but I can tell you what, they helped me. I had things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And over time, I've had to, you know, seek outside help, but I've been able to give outside help now. I'm here having to deal with loss by suicide. So, I still find myself today wondering about emotional sobriety. I've certainly read that article, and I think about it on occasion. I think it's like serenity. You know, it's like a pendulum. We swing in and out of it, in and out of it. And, you know, just this past week, several people have asked me how things are going, and things are good. You know, I'm healthy. I'm sober. Money's okay. There's a lot of good things going on in my life. We had a plumbing issue, and so I'm upset dealing with contractors and insurance and all that. And so I call my sponsor. I'm talking with him. He says, you know, there's things to be grateful for. You've got a house. You've got insurance. You can pay for this. You can communicate with these guys. You can tell them to get the job done. And so, you know, it's really a matter of perspective. It's the way that I see life. I'd give anything for my son Stuart to be here. But, you know, that's not the cards we're dealt. And you mentioned the way that one of the supremely things we can value life is how we handle it, how do we respond to it. Sometimes we get dealt a bad hand. But how are you going to play it? That's sort of the question. Here in AA, I had examples of that. And, in fact, after my son died, a man came to me and his wife had died suddenly, somewhat like my son's death. But it was suddenly, he had kissed her goodbye and he never saw her alive again. And he visited with me and he met with me every week for 6 months. This guy wasn't my sponsor. He was just a guy sort of sharing his experience. And it wasn't like he had some magic bullet, but he knew what to do, and what that was one alcoholic talk with another. And that really is one of those things that sort of transformed me. I think about those times when Art was there. In fact, I really think about all the people who were there. I sort of get chills about the love that was shown to my wife and me. And I never really forget that day. And I see it tremendously different 20 years down the road. Of course, in the midst of it, you can't see anything. You know, you're sort of in shock. But 20 years down the road, it was really a miracle what Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous did. So, you know, today's a great day to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am so glad that I'm here. Thanks.
Thanks, Robert.
Boy, that's a fabulous way to wrap it up. I just, my last comment really is that, you know, if there's a, for me, if there's a silver bullet or a WD-40 for maintaining emotional sobriety, it's gratitude. In a word, it's gratitude. Just like was just determined, or just mentioned, you know, there's always something to be grateful for. I mean, there's awful, terrible things that happen, sure. But, you know, for me, when I'm in a good spiritual place, my life is, I'm in the bonus time here. I ought to be dead. I'm a dead man walking. And that being the case, anything that happens to me is really kind of bonus. That helps me to have emotional sobriety. So thank you all so much. It was been a delight to flap my lips up here a little bit for you. But yeah, hope you enjoyed it.